The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 258 for Friday, April 30th, 2010. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. It is Friday afternoon. It is April 30th. And I'm Dave Hamilton.
Hi, Dave Hamilton. I am John F. Braun. I'm in Fairfield, Connecticut, last I checked.
Yeah, that's right. It looks like it. I can see out your windows there. It is, this is Mac Geek Gab Premium, actually, version episode 258. And we have, actually, John, we have a lot of cool stuff to go through. Is there anything you want to mention before we dive into these questions here?
No.
No. All right. Okay. Well,
were you hoping for something?
No, I just, you know, sometimes we have little tidbits from our lives that we share. This is our third show this week. You know, we had our special show 256, and then we did 257, which was a normal one with all the questions. And now here we are, 258.
I had a fun day. I was out photographing. I told you I found some unexpected things. I like exploring the open space around here, and I take pictures, and every now and then, you'll see the pictures if you follow my pictures. But basically, I found something.
Put a link to your pictures in the show notes.
I mean, I basically found in the middle of the woods technology that I didn't expect in one of the supposed hiking areas in my area. So,
cool.
Anyways, but you'll see the pictures. So, awesome. Anyways, that's about it. And it's a beautiful spring day up here, down here, and I think up there, Dave.
Yep. We're looking for the 80s this weekend. All right, let's go to Tracy here. Tracy says, I just bought my partner a brand new MacBook Pro, which she loves, but she's bummed out that she no longer has an enter key in the bottom row adjacent to the space bar. She really wants to turn the right side alt option key into an enter key, and I'm trying to figure out a way to do this without the total overkill, i.e. Keyboard Maestro, which is an awesome program, but she would never use any of its real functionality, so I'd rather not spend the $35. Suggestions? Elegant solutions? Thank you. All right. I don't really have an answer here. I started looking in system preferences, keyboard shortcuts, and there's a lot of options there, but she can't map enter versus option. There's nothing there. So I think keyboard, you know, for me, it's Keyboard Maestro. But John, I think you found, you might have found the magic answer.
Well, one thing that occurs to me, even though it's not there, Dave, so we're talking about a MacBook Pro, I believe, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's
right. I'm looking at mine right now, and you and I both have the same machine, and I do see that word enter on my return key. And I'm
trying to remember what she's talking about is, and you never had a MacBook Pro prior to this one. The original MacBook Pro actually had an enter key on the bottom row. And it was very handy. It was just a small little, you know, it was like a normal, almost normal size key, like the same as any of your letters would be, but it was enter. And I actually found it really handy. It could, because return and enter sometimes are different things, but even if they aren't, you know, it's handy to have it there. So,
okay. And I think my tie book probably had that.
Yeah, maybe that maybe. Yeah.
So one thing I'm curious about is that I'm seeing this on my MacBook Pro. Is there a way to through the function key or something like that, if that brings it up, even though it's not listed on the key, will that do it? So one thought, I'm not sure if it will. But the other thing is I found, Dave, so there are a few things. So one, you're going to bring one up that, you know, comes in the OS, but I found a thing called double command. Now, this is something we've seen in the past. It's kind of weird in that it only seems to do specific mappings for like command and enter and stuff like that. And I couldn't see the exact mapping that we were looking for here. But it looks like it is somewhat configurable. I think in the past we've kind of disregarded it because they didn't have their act together. I mean, it's an open source project, though, but it did not seem to be... it's doublecommand.sourceforge.net, and it didn't seem to be maintained at the time we looked at it last, I think, Dave. But looking at it now, it's 64-bit. You know, I went to their webpage. It's been updated fairly recently, so it should work fine with Snow Leopard. So, you know, give it a whirl.
Yeah, that looks like it looks like it'll. It's got. Does it have option key? I'm looking at the options.
Yeah, I see a bunch of them, and it has enter and option and stuff like that. So I'm hoping that maybe not the default options, but maybe you can configure it to do what you want. But it seems that this is more specific to some of the more esoteric keys and how to remap them.
Yeah,
I think the thought is also if you go between Mac and Windows, sometimes the way the keys work, and I think that was the inspiration for this program.
Cool.
So that's one. But then Dave, another, of course, you know, just to remap in general.
Well, I mean, there were the two I discussed, right? Keyboard Maestro and then System Preferences, Keyboard Shortcuts is what you're talking about.
Oh, you
weren't paying attention when I said that, were you?
No, of course not.
Okay, good.
No, I was researching the other thing.
Oh, all right. Well, that's fine. All right. Okay, let's move on to Michael then. This is an interesting question. Michael says, hey guys, now that I have my new 27-inch iMac with an i7 chip with 4 gigs of RAM, I was looking at using up the vacant slots in the vacant RAM slots that I have. I've always heard that booting in 32-bit can only use a maximum of 4 gigs of RAM anyway, especially on Windows machines. But further reading shows how macOS 10 uses a special trick called PAE, or physical address extension, that can allow macOS 10 to access up to 32 gigs of RAM. Have you guys heard of this? And is upgrading to more RAM worth it? Okay, so there's actually three questions here. Yes, we've heard of it, and we'll talk, and let's talk about it. And the short answer is upgrading. If you put more than 4 gigs of RAM in your machine, it will see it. The question of to whether or not it's worth it, we'll answer that at the end of this little discussion here. But yeah, so let's talk about this PAE mode, right? Physical address extension. I did some research, and if Wikipedia is to be trusted, which of course it's not, this has been supported since macOS 10 Tiger 10.4.4. And it's been a feature of Intel processors going all the way back to at least 1995. And I think, you know, it was also supported by early Motorola processors, right? Or not early, but earlier.
The only comment I'll make is that, you know, in the past, the processors, I've worked on both Motorola and Intel, and they have different ways of dealing with this. And I guess the core issue is, do you want to have the normal register that you use for doing work be the same size as the address space of the processor? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But even back in the 6502, it wasn't really the case. So
6502, just for reference, and since we had a blast from the past show earlier this week, the 6502 is the chipset that was used in the Apple II series of computer.
Right, and that had 8-bit registers, but it had a 16, other features that were 16-bit. So you're already, you had this problem. I use this many bits for this, this many bits for that. But I guess the in general, even Dave, you and I saw this, again, to go back to the past, but this is, I think, effectively how they're doing this, so they call it fancy names. But back when you and I had the computer, the machine could only address, I believe, 64K at once. Anything beyond that, you had to do what they called page flipping, and I think these new methods are basically just taking that to a very sophisticated level where it's almost transparent.
Is that what it is?
At some level it has to be. I mean, the thing is, it's mapping, and here's where we get into some terminologies. You're mapping logical to physical, is that you may have physical space or logical space, and how to relate the two, so that basically what you're doing is basically fooling the processor or the OS into thinking there's more memory than there should be.
Okay.
Beyond what I'm going to say is the inherent built-in way of the processor doing it. So normally a processor, as we pointed out, 32 bits means you can only see 32 bits of something.
Right. 4 gigs of something. Right.
But, it's not too hard either in software or hardware, and I've seen both, where you can just put a little trick in there saying, all right, I'm going to trick you into thinking that you're seeing memory, you know, in this larger space. And the thing is, you actually are. So it's but it's a challenge. It's kind of going beyond, I think, what the processor manufacturers intended. They're like, oh, gee, well, we only think we need this much address space. It's like, no. Not anymore. So here's a trick, either in the chip itself or in the operating system that, you know, pulls us off. So
got it.
A little kind of boring and maybe too geeky background, but it's an interesting trend because right now, I think, Dave, we're talking 64-bit, right? We're all
correct.
Rah-rah about 64-bit.
Correct.
But the thing is, there's even in our 64-bit processors, I believe there are some 128-bit or even beyond elements. So it's like,
I think that's right. Yeah.
When do we get to that point? Or do we need it? And I remember we discussed that.
Do we need it? I mean, you know, anytime I ask the question or I catch myself even thinking, let alone saying, do I need more? I remind myself that, first of all, my first computer didn't even have a hard drive, but the first computer that I had with a hard drive was my SE30. I got it in 1989, and it had a 40 megabyte hard drive. And there was an option to get it with the 80 megabyte hard drive. And I thought, well, I'll never need that. Obviously, that goes without saying. I think the program that we're using, one of the programs that we're using to do our internet chat, Skype, is larger than 40 megabytes all by itself. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. So, yes, the short answer is you don't even have to care about physical address extension. But your Mac knows how to do it. The processor knows how to do it. And yes, if you put more than 4 gigs of RAM in, even if you're booted to a 32-bit kernel, you will be able to see them. The question is to whether or not it's worth it.
Yes.
And I think I have my window open and my kids are getting home, so we're going to hear them walk by. But you know, whether or not it's worth it, it depends. Take a look. If you've got 4 gigs in there now, run, you know, you can do it with Activity Monitor, but you can also check out, you know, something like Menu Meters or iStat Menus and see how much RAM is free, not inactive and free, but see how much RAM is free at any given point in time. And if you're running up against the limits of that, then yes, you do need more than 4 gigs of RAM. If you're not, then no, you don't. So that's my short answer. And another benchmark to check again with Activity Monitor or any of the aforementioned tools is how much swap space you're using. You know, on this machine right now, I've only got 3 gigs of RAM, but I'm only using 15 megabytes of swap space, which tells me that I'm not running up against the limits of the RAM that I have in this machine.
Right.
So.
Yeah, good point. Now, my feedback is that on the MacBook Pro, when I went from 4 to 6, which is not officially, you know, we're being kind of bad here. And I think, did you change yours?
No, I got to do that, though. Yeah.
You do, because, you know, to me, it was a world of difference.
I'm making a note.
Because I think OS X, 2 gigs is the bare minimum.
Yeah, I agree with that.
4 gigs if you're running more than one or two apps. And then my experience, because I typically, and you know, I don't follow our advice all the time, Dave, which I don't always shut down my apps when I'm done using them. I may leave iPhoto or Word or whatever open. And the thing is, the more apps open, the more memory is potentially required. Now, sometimes it'll, you know, swap or do the swap magic, but I found that on the MacBook Pro, where I typically am running 5-6 apps at once, 6 gigs and 4 gigs was like a world of difference. And I think the other stat you want to look at, Dave, is, you know, depending on the utility you use, but the if you didn't mention this, but the page outs, once you start doing page outs,
page outs are certainly
related.
A measure, right, because swap doesn't happen without them. But I always just look at the amount of swap I'm using, and that's the that's the magic.
Is that the red phone?
It is, but I can let it go. It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like your people took care of it.
It's been taken care of.
But between two, and I was shocked, Dave, is the other day, once I did do this, now the thing is, every now and then I would reach the maximum amount of RAM, but I've never seen this before in extended usage, but I would notice the number of swap files would decrease, which I got to say, I've never seen that before when I had 4 gigs. When I got 6 gigs, I started seeing that figure not only go up, which is typically my warning sign that it's time to reboot soon,
right,
but I've seen it go down. And I think just having the breathing room, I think that's why I finally saw that.
Yeah. Interesting. So you got you just bought a 4 gig module from somebody. Is that what you did?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, OWC. Because, well, they had the report, you know, and they had the best price at the time. But yeah.
What'd you pay for it? Do you remember? Ballpark?
About 120.
Wow. They're showing 185 right now.
Hey. Yeah, you got to move.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I did. Apparently, they got a good price. It sees it. You know, I popped the other chip. Actually, I should put that on eBay or something. Anybody wants a 2 gig chip that works in...
Actually, I might take that from you. I got to look, but I might want it for one of my iMacs.
Ah, so sweet.
Yeah. All right. But, you know, we're not here just to chit-chat about it. I guess we kind of are here to chit-chat about that.
But we're also here to talk about, are we done with,
I think so.
RAM?
I think so. Yeah, that was okay. That was good. A valuable discussion.
And then we have a tale of woe from Dennis.
We do. Yeah. Dennis wrote, I dug out my 1998 iMac G3 from deep in the closet and it will not boot. I simply get the Finder with a flashing question mark, or not really a Finder. It's just the Mac screen with a flashing question mark. I've tried booting from CD, both Mac OS 9 and Mac OS 10, a backup drive, resetting the PRAM, no luck. Any ideas? So far, everything I've read says just boot from the CD, but in my case, that's not working. So I have one idea, John. I've seen this, and I haven't seen it with that model iMac, but I've seen it with later model iMac, with my my old flat screen Intel iMac, that when the PRAM battery or the CMOS battery, whatever you want to call that battery inside the computer, died, it acted just like this. I could not get it to do anything other than basically what he's describing here. So the fact that it's been sitting in his closet for a long time and hasn't been in use, chances are, you know, the battery at some point along the line died. Assuming that machine has a battery in it, and I'm pretty sure it does.
If it's the one that I worked on, Dave.
Yep.
Which, if you want to hand it off here. Yep. So I worked on one of these. I had actually a former client that lived down the street and had one of these machines. And her problem was that, yeah, she would turn the thing on and it would flash the question mark. I'm like, oh, man. Well, there were two problems. Number one, the power switch on this particular, and I remember this machine because this is the first one that had people shaking their fists about the floppy drive, right?
Sure.
Where is a floppy drive on the Mac? And I believe that machine did have a connector on the motherboard.
Is that right?
I'm pretty sure it did, but they didn't offer it. So you could hack it to use a floppy. But, you know, the time of the floppy, you know, has come and gone.
Right.
Anyways, so but what I eventually found. So number one, this machine had a problem with the power button sticking. So that was the one piece of service that I had to do, was actually take it out, clean it out, resolder the wires, stuff like that. Because it was intermittent. So that was her one problem. The other one is once I booted it, yeah, it would show the smiley disk and a flashing question mark. It's like, oh, now what? On that model machine, at least, I remember the way I figured out what the problem was if you hold down, I believe it's Alt or Option on pretty much any Mac, and even that one. Maybe it was a different key, but here's the suggestion. You know, try a few different ones. Of course, sure. You have to plug in the keyboard. One of them will bring up a menu where it's the Mac is basically saying, all right, here's all the things I see. Which one should I boot from? It kind of skips, because the thing is, by default, what the Mac does is whatever it was in your startup items. I think that's what it's called.
Yep.
Or startup disk. Whatever startup disk is... If it's defined, it'll try that. If it's not defined, then usually I think most Macs still default to netboot, which is, you know, a kind of cool thing where you go on a network and you say, hey, is there any bootable device? I don't know any of the details of this, Dave. I just know it's called netboot.
Okay.
I've seen it demoed at Macworld. But the thing is, first, it's going to try to crawl the network and say, hey, is anybody out here willing to boot me? The thing is, a lot of times that takes a real long time from what I've seen. And actually, this machine, I mean, it would sit there for minutes just saying, anybody out there? Anybody out there? It's like, no. Let's hold down Option, put in the CD. And the thing is, by holding down Option, you force the machine to look at all the bootable devices before it offers one, and not get stupid and just say, hey, I'm going to look on the network. And that's how it worked out. It actually did see the CD then and was able to boot from it. So that machine, I think, had a flaw in that it spent way too much time trying desperately to boot from something that was never going to be available.
Right. Huh. That's interesting. Interesting. All right. Yeah. So hopefully that heads you down a path there, Dennis, that helps out. All right. What are we moving on to? Rick. Let me see if I can find Rick's audio here and we can do this the right way.
Dave, John, and Pete, this is Rick from New York State. For my third year as a switcher, I thought that I would try to contribute something. I've been listening to you for a long time, and I want to thank you all for helping me through the switching thing. And unfortunately, every time I have a question within a show or two, you seem to answer it. But
that's a good thing.
Here I am just catching up at the end of March, and you were talking a few shows ago about DNS and blocking, and I do have a question. I have a teenager who I need to keep off Facebook every once in a while, and what she's found is that if she goes into Google and Google's Facebook, she can get on the site through one of the other countries, and even with parental controls, that doesn't seem to block it. So I was wondering if there was any way using DNS to block her out. and even if it's possible to do it during different times of the day. The other thing is that you were having your little aviation geek gab a little while ago, and you, David, said something about you were talking about aircraft performance, and I think the term you were looking for was coffin corners. That has to do with how the manufacturers use graph the data for altitude versus airspeed, and as you get up towards the service ceiling of the aircraft, it forms two kind of angles. Well, they're obtuse angles, so I guess I could say that since this is a geek gab.
It is.
And if you go a little bit too slow, the airflow over the wing stalls out, and if you go a little bit too fast, it does what's called a mock tuck, and the aircraft will go down in either case. So Pilot Pete could probably explain it a little bit better to you, but thanks for all you do, and hope you have an answer for me. And you can cut me off in 3, 2, 1.
Awesome. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for the coffin corner thing there. Yeah, that's a fun little diversion. All right. As far as domain blocking, the OpenDNS will do this. In fact, it's built for it. So what you want to do is sign up with a free account at opendns.com. And then you point your, presumably you've got all your computers connected to one router and they're getting their IP address and network information from that router. Assuming that they are, all you need to do is go to your router, and OpenDNS even has instructions for this, but you go to your router and you set all of the DNS entries on the router itself to OpenDNS. You're changing them from what you're getting as the default from your internet service provider and changing those to OpenDNS. And then you can go in and you run a little client on one of your Macs to keep OpenDNS apprised of your current IP address. And then by IP address, OpenDNS knows whether or not to filter you. And you can set at their website exactly what you want to filter. You can pick categories or you can pick specific domains. So yeah, that should do it for you. What OpenDNS won't do is it doesn't have a time of day based filtering or enable or disable, you know, a homework hours kind of thing. It doesn't exist at OpenDNS proper. But if you buy, there is one router out that is built to integrate with OpenDNS, and it's really just a software thing. So presumably other routers could do this very easily. But the Netgear WNR2000, which is a wireless 802.11n router, will integrate with OpenDNS, and it supports the homework hours, you know, time-based blocking things. So that's one option. I saw, and I didn't have time to check it out, but I did see another website that'll do something, or another piece of software, and it is available for the Mac, called K9WebProtection.com. It's the letter K, the number 9, and then webprotection.com. And they have a Mac piece of Mac software, but didn't have an opportunity to check it out. Lastly, if you are running a Linksys router and others that support the firmware I'm always talking about, which is called DD-WRT, you can do this. It's a lot geeky getting it installed on your router. And then the configuration of it is non-trivial, but it's not too bad. You go to the access restrictions tab, and you go in and you can set time-based access. You can actually limit, you can set up profiles for each computer in your house if you want. So you've got, you know, you could have your computer accessing Facebook, but another computer not accessing Facebook, and you can turn it all on and off at different times of day. So those are my three technological solutions. One thing I will point out with any of these, although the DD-WRT thing is limiting by MAC address or IP address, depending on how you do it. So that's pretty much that's going to do it. But if you're using OpenDNS, you want to make sure that the kids or the person you're trying to block does not have administrative access on their machine. If they do, they can go into system preferences, into the network, and change or add a DNS server. So if all you're doing is DNS blocking, which is what OpenDNS does, if they try to look up Facebook, it doesn't resolve that name. It resolves it to something else and says you're blocked from seeing this. But if they can set another DNS server in their in their system preferences, then they'll totally bypass OpenDNS. It'll, you know, it's just not part of the solution. So you've got to make sure they don't have administrator access on the machine. Otherwise, they will find a way to get around it. So,
yeah, well, I like the option. So what you do is you create a managed account, which is a standard account with parental controls. And then in the content tab, you can go to website restrictions and say allow access to only these websites.
Oh, so, yeah.
What I'm suggesting is you put your foot down and you say, listen, kids, but these are the only sites that I'm going to permit you to go to, because, you know, I'm, you know, armchair parent here. And I think that's the best way, which is just to enforce, unfocused discipline, you know, and strict rules for no reason. I think that's the way to do it.
It's the right way to parent, huh, John? All right. Well, hey, you know,
to be serious, yes, I know people like you, Dave, and others that have kids and all that. And I think the social thing we were going to get into is, the technology is easy, but the thing is, if the kids are really, I think in my humble opinion, remembering when I was a kid, and I think Dave, you remember when you were a kid,
if
a kid wants to get to something, they will figure, if they're, you know, energized enough, they will figure a way to get around these lame technological restrictions. So to me, it's certainly a tool to help discourage bad behavior, but it has to be associated with, well, here's why I'm doing this.
That I agree with 100%. I think it is different now than when you and I were kids. I mean, first of all, our parents,
for us, it was like the Wild West. And I think some parts of the internet still are like that. You just stumble across something that, whoa.
Right. Right. Well, you know, but here's the thing. First of all, our parents, and my dad was an engineer. I mean, he understood computers, but he really had only a very cursory knowledge of that which I was doing on the computer, right? I mean,
mine had almost no clue unless I offered it.
Right.
Oh, check out what I can get.
Yeah, pretty much that was how it was in my house, too. So, first of all, our parents really didn't know what it was we could get into to begin with, let alone, what it was we were doing. So that's different now. Right. I certainly know, maybe I don't know everything my kids can get into, but I certainly know far more than my parents knew about me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Number two is there's far more for my kids to get into than there was back then. Right. It's a whole different world. I think putting some technological barriers in place is good, if only to stop inadvertent activity or a reminder that the activity that you're about to try and figure out how to do is something that we as parent and child have discussed as off limits. Right. You know, it doesn't help. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt to have, again, either a barrier as a reminder or as a failsafe. However, I agree with you. You know, the first thing that has to happen is the conversation of you shouldn't be doing this in the first place. Right. You know, and now we'll put some things in place that remind you, yes, you know, help guide you down the right path. And that's a good thing. So that's my feeling anyway.
Pretty much. And I've seen, we're not the Mac social gap, but I've seen even some school districts and other, you know, workplaces will limit certain social media things, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah, really I was at the high school last night. They had a mm-hmm. donkey ball match, which is donkey basketball.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it was a blast.
What? Is this in New Hampshire?
I don't know where they came from.
I don't remember donkey ball in these parts.
I'd never heard of it before, John. This is okay. This is something that. But anyway, they have a Wi-Fi network. They have two Wi-Fi networks at the school. One that's secured, and then one that's, you know, for guests. And so I put my iPhone on the network, and I was able to get email. But I was unable to post anything to Twitter, so I had to disable the network. Mm. And I even tried VPNing into my house, and then I was going to post that way to kind of obscure my traffic. Wouldn't let me VPN either, which I thought was pretty darn sneaky. I'm sure Skype would have worked. You know how Skype is.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're back on. Are we back on track here? How are we doing on time? We got a lot to. We got a lot we can go through. We can. We can do whatever we want here. Okay. Stefan. All right, yeah. All right, let's pull this up. In the last show, we talked about permissions in your home directory and how you may not realize that some things are accessible to the outside world when not the outside world, but other users on that machine. And some things are blocked from them. And we had suggested that that you one of the reasons that your home directory itself, though not necessarily the contents thereof, but your home directory itself is readable to other computers or other users on that same computer because you have your public folder and your sites folder. So Stefan had a comment about that, and then we'll take it from there.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Stefan from Hamburg, Germany. I'd like to comment on the Unix permissions issues and Spotlight. Dave stated in the last show that the home directory has to be readable only to access the public and sites folders. If I remember correctly from my old Linux days, it is sufficient to have only the executable flag set for all users in order to be able to access the public folder. Yeah. Bye, and have a nice day.
Thank you, Stefan. Yeah. You are right in that if all you're trying to do is get directly to that folder, the parent folder does not have to be readable. Now, you have to know the path, you have to know the name, and you have to be doing it either from the command line or using the Finder's go to folder menu item, right? But if you want to navigate there by clicking on your hard drive and then users and then a username and then public, at that point, yes, you do have to have the Finder will not navigate to the user's folder without that being readable. So that was kind of my thinking on it. But you're absolutely right, Stefan. That's that, you know, if you want to get there, you can get there even if the parent folder is not world readable.
Huh. Well, I like his point about the executable flag, Dave, because this gets into the nuts and bolts of, well, what do all those bits mean when you're doing a chmod and stuff like that? And I think they are.
I think if you're doing a chmod, people probably know what they're doing, but maybe not. Yeah. Maybe not.
Well, no, I thought I'd spit it out, but I think the order of the flags from least to most, I think, is read, write, and execute. Is that right?
Most to least, because if you do what John's talking about is a very old Unix command called chmod, chmod, and you use it to set the permissions on files or folders or items from the command line. And I believe I did this earlier today, so I know at least some of it. If you do a chmod of 111, that makes the file user, like owner, group, and world executable and nothing else. The one is definitely executable. I believe if you make it 333, then it's I gotta look it up. Yeah, I think it is. 333 would make it world read user group and world read and execute, and then six. It might be four. The first three are readable. The second three are writable, and then one to make it seven. Because 777 is world read, write, and execute. So it's three for read, three for write, and one for execute. So yes. So there you go. And the way the numbers work is 333. It's user, owner, rather, group, and execute. So if you wanted to make it owner, read, write, execute, and then world group and world execute only, it's 711. And that'll
sweet.
Give you that.
Sweet. Nice work.
Well, you know, try. Yeah, it gets a little crazy. Here's what I do. Is I do chmod space. I don't use numbers because of that. I have to sit and think if I want to do, owner or whatever. I do A plus X, and that'll give everybody the executable bit, and it's good to go.
So I read a few articles. So we're digging into some, esoteric or maybe not so of why the chmod and the other bits are the way they are.
Yeah.
User, group, world, all that good stuff.
Yeah, everyone, right.
Yeah. Or everyone, which we've seen, yeah, may bite you if you don't know about everyone.
That's right. All right, so now should we get esoteric in a different way? Mm-hmm. Ready?
Excuse me. Yes.
Okay.
Hi, John and Dave. I love your show, been a longtime listener. But now I have a problem and I need your help. In 1994, I bought an HP LaserJet 5MP printer, which I just love. And years later, when I got an iMac 20-inch G5, I had to buy an Asante Ethernet cable bridge because Apple had abandoned the 9-pin DIN cable. So the now I have a 27-inch i5 iMac, and both HP and Apple say that I can print to the 5MP, but Apple Talk has been discontinued with this model. So the I'm obviously getting nothing when I print. But since they both say that I can print to it, how do I do it? I assume I have to buy some kind of a bridge, but I don't know what it is. So if you could possibly tell me, I'd be very pleased. Here's where you cut me off.
All right, and we shall. So, you know, I had an answer already for this, John, but of course, because Apple Talk's discontinued, it won't work. You know, I have one of those old Asante Ether bridge things that bridges Ethernet to local talk, but I don't think that'll work. Right, because it's not there. I don't think it will.
Yeah, no. You and I were talking about some devices we had in the past.
I actually still have them. I found them the other night when I was hunting for that acoustic coupler.
But so this is a LaserJet 5MP, and as pointed out, but we'll go over it again. It has IRDA, which is infrared. That I couldn't find an adapter for. On the Mac, there may be one out there. Actually, if anybody knows about an IRDA, which is infrared data, something, whatever. Basically, it's and you've seen this. You know, if you had a Palm or something like that, it's infrared. It's an LED, or it's like the ones that you have in your remote control. So that's number one. That I couldn't find anything for. And number two, of course, local talk, as they pointed out, and that's the old high speed serial that Apple actually kind of pioneered, and it was actually very nice.
Yeah. It was really cool, actually, because you could string computers together.
Yeah, before. And basically, you had it was basically plugged into the Mac, and then you would have a connector with two ports, and it basically daisy chained. So basically, you would plug two other computers into this connector. And now the only downside is if anybody in the chain, you know, tripped over a cable or something, then that part of the network was disappeared.
Yeah, but it was pretty robust about it. I mean, it didn't blow away the rest of the network. It was just part of it. Yeah,
but still, it was a faulty, you know, versus a hub or a switch or something. Oh,
much different. Yeah. Yeah.
So then the third option. So here, and I think Joe has written back that I think he's looking into this. I don't know if he was successful, but the third option is parallel. Well, you know, parallel. The problem is parallel is not serial. Macs, for the most part, use serial interfaces, whether it be 232 or 422 or whatever, or local talk or Apple talk. You know, it's all kind of serial based. The Mac never really grokked the whole parallel interface, which was very popular on the PC. What I did find, though, which I think it is the best solution that I can offer, someone makes a USB to parallel cable and it offers a Mac adapter. Or driver, so we'll see how good that's written. But it was like $9. So, you know, to me, now I got to say, this guy, I mean, I thought I was hardcore, and I think actually he worked on the firmware on my printer. But I think he wrote me that. But a LaserJet 5MP, Dave, is an old. I mean, I thought my laser printer was old, the GCC 1200.
You still have that?
This is older. Well, it has an Ethernet port. See, I was thinking ahead. Now, I think it has a probably 10 megabit Ethernet port, not a,
who cares?
You know, 100 or gigabit, but still, it's fast enough for my black and white printing. So, I still, and I haven't even used the first toner cartridge, which is people, obviously, I can see why they almost went out of business was because the products last way too long.
Right.
I mean, look, I've done nothing to this thing for 10 years, and it's still printing on number 10 paper. So,
that's crazy.
That's why I got the Ethernet, because I think they did offer, they're like, okay, would you want a local talk interface or this or that? And I'm like, you know, I think I'll get the brand spanking new Ethernet, which was, you know, kind of unusual back then. I think it was actually a special circuit board that I had to screw into the printer because it was so brand new.
Sure.
You know, it's actually pretty advanced. I mean, it's slow, but it has a web server interface. You can basically change anything on the, yeah. And
this actually, I remember when they came out, I remember reading about those in Mac Week when they came out and being really, really excited about the possibility of it. I lusted after it, actually. That was one of those things when you bought it. It was like, oh, he got one of those. I should get one.
Well, I remember in my old workplace, what I did one time is right. Now, remember this tool called Satan?
No.
It was one of these.
That's a security tool, right?
Yeah. Well, it was one of these tools. And I still remember, in the workplace when they started rolling out TCP/IP, I would run this and actually I would have devices come up and I'm like, oh, what is that? And some of the devices I found were, I think it was Tektronix.
Okay.
But it was laser printers that all of a sudden had port 80 exposed because they had a web server where you could come to them and say, hi, how's it going? What's your status? No, it's very cool when they finally introduced that. Cool. So, yeah, it's still running. Again, I hope I can still get a toner cartridge.
Oh,
if and when I run out.
Well, let's put it this way. That printer doesn't owe you anything, right?
No.
It might not be worth the investment in the toner cartridge.
No.
Although, some places have them pretty cheap. So, all right, let's hear from Sandro. What do you think, John? Yeah?
All right. Yes.
Hi, guys. Sandro here from the My Photo Tech podcast. You guys talk a lot about, especially John, the iStat menus and the temperature sensors for the Mac. I also use iStat menus as well as the iStat Pro, which is the widget. I have a question on these temperatures. Where can I find a good reference, or maybe you guys know already, what are the temperatures that we should expect here to be within normal range? For example, right now I'm ripping a DVD using Handbrake. It's been going on for a while, and I'm on a MacBook Pro generation before this one. And my Handbrake is pegging the processors here at about 195% on the average. And, of course, the fans are running. And the temperature here, the highest reading for the CPU is 196 degrees. The heat sink's 155. The GPU is 148. And so what kind is that, within range or what? The fans are running at 6204, both of them, 6204 RPM. All right. Yeah, I'd really like to know that. I look at these temperatures and I say, well, that's cool. What does it mean? Thanks a lot.
All right, Sandra. Yeah. Or, maybe it's not cool. Maybe it's hot. John, sorry. Anyway, John, you looked up some specs on this, right?
I did.
I think you did.
Yes. No, I did. So the thing is, in general, if as you notice, I would say just the general guidelines. So what I've seen on the at least the MacBooks that I've run, once you start getting in the low 100s, but that's about normal. As you start climbing towards 200 degrees Fahrenheit, and remember, we're American, so we do things stupid, which is Fahrenheit. Because I'm finding all the utilities, or at least the resources I found. Well, they measure it in both, but still, it's kind of annoying. And as you start climbing in like 150 or whatever range, your fans probably should be going on. I have never seen a device come in at over 200 degrees Fahrenheit. So, but I did find a site, Dave, called www.intelmactemp.com/list. We'll link to it, of course. But it lists temperatures by default in Celsius or centigrade, but you can go to degrees Fahrenheit and see the temps for all sorts of systems. And there are submissions dating back from 2006 all the way to the current day. They default to showing the oldest first. So, you may have to jump ahead, but that's a place I would look. And then maybe just, I've gotten a feel, and you probably have too, Dave. I mean, my feel is, if I see, like right now I'm looking over my MacBook and it's 140. Okay, that's about right, and I think the fans are running. But that in the 100, low 100 something range to me is at least in a portable R class, what I would expect. So,
yeah, the fan speed is interesting. I think on my iMac, I see it. The fans are always spinning, even in our portable machines.
About 2,000.
At 2,000 is the bottom default speed, and then they will speed up as the temperature heats up. On my iMac, it's 1,200, I think, and it's the same deal. It'll speed up. Now, the new iStat menus, which is iStat menus 3, they Bajango, which is the company that makes it, decided that the only way they were going to be able to continue to make it was to charge for it. Yeah, well, it's $10 or $19 if you want a license for 5 computers. So it's, you know, it's not that big of a deal. They're not paying us to say that, but we've been talking about this for so long. It's worth letting you all know.
I dig it.
It's an application now instead of a pref pane, but the menus still work the same. One cool thing that they've added in version 3, they've added a couple cool things, and one relates to this, is that you can actually set different profiles for your system fans. So if you know, say you're going to be doing some handbrake, you know, conversions or whatever, and you just want to let the fans run hotter or run faster to keep the temperature down, you can do that. And you can set right now, you know, the default set is whatever the Mac, whatever your Mac's set to. And then they've got a medium set that's built in and that may be different for each computer. But on mine, I'm trying to see if I can even look at what that medium set is. Yeah, but for me, the medium set is 2350. So it is different for each computer. It's 2350, and you can have different rules depending on what the default is, what happens when you're on battery power versus when you're not, and then also what happens when you're charging. So you can, you know, you can set some things up depending on your environment that work for you and keep your temperatures lower, almost artificially, right? Because you're doing more than Apple figures you needed. But that's what these geeky tools are for. So,
well, you know, I'm interested because, I mean, you have a combination of variables here. I think it's kind of cool. So you have how much power are you drawing at a certain temperature, which as the temperature goes up, I guess you would be drawing relatively more power.
Sure.
Versus the power to the fans to cool the processor. Right. And is the power required to cool it worth, you know, spending the extra power on cooling versus just letting it run hotter, and then you got the heat sinks and
interesting.
Anyways, I'm going to stop. Yeah,
that's
obviously
point.
These guys are offering the option of you. But I think I'm with you. You know, if you're running something you know is going to be cranking on the processor, maybe you just want to run the fans at 6,000 or whatever the maximum of the fans are. I've noticed mine. Actually, I can hear that when the fans in my MacBook Pro get towards maximum.
Sounds
I hear
like
them rattle. Well, I hear them rattle a little bit, and then I don't know if a bearing's gone or something. We'll see.
That's what Apple cares for, man.
Yes, sir. But no, it still runs day to day. I mean, it runs, you know, rarely do I get it where it's blasting the fans full speed.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even have, I do a lot of handbrake conversions on the dual core iMac over at the house. And so that runs the CPUs at 100%. And I don't notice the fans going that fast. They might double speed up to, you know, 2,500 RPM or something, but nothing faster than that. So, I'm going to talk about, what am I going to do? I don't know what I'm going to do.
I don't know.
I want to spread more love about iStat menus. Another thing that they added in this version 3, which I didn't even notice at first, and then I stumbled onto it, is they added a new battery widget. And this battery widget, you can use it to replace. You can just turn off the energy saver one on your portable and have this one come. And it's got some cool things. First of all, of course, you can customize it every which way from Sunday, because that's what iStat Menus does. Some of those customizations, though, is you can have it look different depending on whether you're charging, whether it's fully charged or whether it's draining. Right. So you can, you know, if it's fully charged, you may not even want to see the time up there. You might only need to see one little thing. It doesn't matter. You know, I don't need to see an icon of a full battery and 100%. I mean, I don't need, you know, fine. So you can do that. You can change the menu bar icon to red as it hits a lower, you know, a lower number. You pick maybe a 10%. You want it to be red, or 20% or 25%, whatever you want. And then, you know, how you get your first warning when you're at 10%, John, on your you know, when you get down to 10%, it warns you. You can actually configure a second warning. So maybe you want your first warning to be at 15% and your second warning at 5%. You can do that too. So it really cool stuff. Yeah, I wish it were free, but I also wish that they'd keep developing it. So I spent my $19.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Well, you know, I got a bunch of computers to run it on, so that was the cheapest way to do it. But they don't pay us to say that. You know,
nope.
So it is what it is.
They could.
Yeah. Maybe they won't. Yeah, they could. We're kind of sold out on ads right now. But they could. You know, there's always room. Contact information. You know, it's Friday afternoon, so maybe we should let everybody go home early. What do you think, John? I know, I mean, you know, we're at about the 50-minute mark, which if you go back to the beginning of when we started this
show. Where's the band?
45 minutes in and we're done, you know.
Where's the band?
Well, the band, you know, they were out taking five because they didn't expect to have to work so soon.
There they are. Because like, I'm sorry, I'm fixed. I got to hear the band if I'm going to talk about how you can get in touch with us, Dave. And one way you can get in touch with us is to call us on the telephone. And you would do that by picking up the telephone speaking into it.
No.
Or gesturing towards entering 206-666-GEEK, which is, Dave?
4335. You can email us. And everyone here is a premium subscriber, of course. So you can email us at premium@macgeekgab.com.
That's right. Premium@macgeekgab.com.
Did you say premium@macgeekgab.com, John?
No.
Okay, good. you can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab, and you can visit our great show notes by our own John F. Braun at macgeekgab.com.
Mm-hmm. And on Twitter, if you still use that thing, I don't know, I'm getting kind of sick of it myself, but... I'm John F. Braun. Dave is Dave Hamilton. Mac Geek Gab is Mac Geek Gab. And General Mac Observer News is Mac Observer.
There you go. All right. Michael Johnston from the This Week in iPhone podcast converts these to AAC for you. CashFly hosting at CACHEFLY.com provides all the bandwidth to get the podcast from us to you. And, that's it. You know, we're good to go. Let's
nice day. I'm gonna go hiking again, I think.
Yeah,
still light
let's
out.
Let's do it.
Look at that. All right. When I was hiking, Dave, I saw some places where there were cameras, and you know what that means.
Made up.